Now, last year, you might remember, I spoke to the French political analyst Dominique Moisy about his new thesis on how big international groupings can be characterised by different emotions, that at the moment both Europe and the US are dominated by fear, with worries around a loss of their national identity and purpose, whereas hope dominated Asia and the region around it, including us, he said, and that humiliation pervaded the Islamic world. And we had quite a lot of good response to that interview. Well, our first story this hour arises directly out of Moisy's analysis. We've invited two highly respected analysts and public intellectuals who hail from the Muslim world to join us now. How do they think their societies might emerge from that sense of humiliation? Because they do agree with the Moisy description, yet they differ in how solutions might be found. Professor Vali Nasr's with us. Early last year, he was appointed Special Advisor on the Middle East to Ambassador Richard Holbrooke, the US envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan. He's one of the foremost thinkers in the arena, and he's having a lot of influence with his new book, Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class, and he believes that globalised capitalism will rescue societies in the Middle East. Dr. Elizabeth Suzanne Kassab is a philosopher. She's had rave reviews for her latest work, Contemporary Arab Thought, in which she lays bare with brutal candour the overwhelming sense of malaise and despair that accompanied her Lebanese community as she grew up, and as far as she could see, extended to all Arab life. And I'll get her to explain how places like Latin America and the Caribbean might be crucial to any cultural overhaul. So I'm delighted to welcome you both to Saturday Extra. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, thank you.
To cut to your argument first, Vali Nasr, and to cut to the chase, you say the problems of the Muslim world is not too much religion, but too little global economy. Now, why do you say that?
Well, if we thought about one of the key issues that distinguishes the Muslim world from many other parts of the Muslim world is that particularly in its heartland, but also in many other of its outlying areas, it by and large sits outside of the global economy, meaning that it's not really part of the globalization that swept across Latin America, Eastern Europe, and Asia. It's not part of the supply chain of globalization. And as a result, the dynamic that we've seen connecting changing societies to adoption of capitalism, trade, integration into the global economy is not at work. The kinds of political and social changes that the West yearns for in the Muslim world happened in Latin America, in East Asia, in Eastern Europe, in conjunction and pursuant to development of vibrant economic sectors that were vested into the global economy, that produced new middle classes that were tied to these open market economies that were emerging. And this is a fundamental dynamic that is lacking in the Muslim world. And often the assumption is that the Muslim world has to culturally change, moderate its religion, preferably secularize before it can develop. Whereas evidence from Europe and elsewhere is that that impetus for cultural change has to come from economic change, and that is fairly absent in the Muslim world.
And you say that where engagement with the global economy does occur, you don't necessarily have a sort of bromide that brings westernization necessarily, but you have more moderate forms of the jihadism that erupts or that rumbles along, or the political engagement. So are you saying that it introduces broader power groups within society? You have checks and balances simply emerge?
Well, that's true. I mean, definitely where integration into the global economy has happened has not produced secularization. What it has produced is certain impetus within the Muslim world, which is tied to a rising middle class, which essentially is embracing of the world. When you go to places like Dubai or Turkey or Malaysia and Indonesia, you don't find pious Muslims, particularly in the middle classes, looking to jihadist or extremist views that are world-denying. They're actually interested in consumption. They're interested in better education for their children. They're interested in shopping. The people like Dubai, not because it's an Islamic Sharia land, but because it's something a cross between Las Vegas and Disneyland, but in an Islamic milieu. And that's a positive development, which means that there's a sense of trying to balance piety with what are their economic interests and engaging the broader world. We don't know what comes of it, but it's definitely not what Osama bin Laden and the extremists are preaching and would like to see.
Elizabeth Kassab, your response to this thesis about how Arab societies and Muslim societies more generally might emerge?
Well, to tell you the truth, I feel a bit uncomfortable to speak about the Muslim world. I don't know much about that, and I think that it might not be very useful to characterize societies and countries in terms of their religion. I think that I can speak a little bit more confidently about the Arab world, and I must say that the malaise in the Arab world is very deep, because it has been, among other factors, it has been struck by many geopolitical events, unhappy events. When we look back at the 20th century, I think this is a century full of disasters for the Arab world. So the malaise has something to do with the political aspects, definitely with the economic issues, and I very much appreciate this economic approach to the malaise. But I think that for a long time we have looked at the Arab world in terms of itself or also in terms of its religion, namely Islam. And I think that by trying to put the discussions around this malaise in a broader comparative perspective helped me to identify the problems as being not so much Arab or Muslim, but rather as being a post-colonial malaise. And I think that my comparison between Arab debates on culture and Latin American and African debates are very enlightening in that sense.
And what did it, because in your book, you in a way suggest that the Arab world, much like a depressed individual, has to come through with a whole new story, an internal dialogue. And you're very eloquent in your book about the sorts of painful questions an Arab has asked him or herself about their predicament, but the ones they ought to be asking. And central to it is a particular breakthrough, as I could see it anyway, that you don't frame your new ideas around the Great West because it has all these overtones of colonialism. And the trouble is, I would have thought that Vali Nasr's capitalism is synonymous with the West. So in a way, it traps you, I suppose, if you go with this economic way out.
You know, the issues, the problems of cultural malaise have been in the Arab world for at least 150 years now. And many, many of the questions are old questions. So be it the economic side, Western capitalism, colonialism, of course, has been there for quite a while. And I think that if one reads closely Arab critical thinkers, and I think we don't pay enough attention to critical thinkers, there is a lot of literature on Islamism, on fundamentalism, and earlier a lot had been written about nationalism, but I think very little attention is paid to men and women who are not very spectacular, maybe, or very noisy, but do a very, very deep kind of self-reflective work, especially in the second half of the 20th century. People sit and engage in a self-reflective, self-examining exercise. It's not that much, you know, this polemics and apologetics with the West, we, us, and them, and what have you, but rather, what have we done with ourselves? And I think that it is a phenomenon of the post-colonial world, a coming of age of the post-colonial era, when also you find this with African and Latin American thinkers who sit down and say, okay, what have we done of this post-independence era? And the most important finding that I concluded was that the main problem, the main puzzle is the post-independence state. And my question is, to what extent would economic changes like the rise of a middle class and consumerism and global economic ties really change something in the post-colonial state? That is, for me, the crucial question.
Well, has it in the places that you've come to identify with Latin America?
I don't think so. I haven't seen it. Actually, I visited Doha a couple of weeks ago, and I was, of course, very impressed. The economic boom is fantastic. There is so much money, so much construction. And, of course, one can easily say, yes, this is all money, this is all superficial, this is just building. But on the other hand, I was very impressed by the Islamic Art Museum. I was very impressed by the education city, all those university branches being opened. Mm. And then the slogans were fantastic. In yellow, they would read, think, dream big, explore. The motto of Qatar Foundation is unlock human potential. My God, I thought that's fantastic. But two questions. I thought, does the government realize what that means, what that would imply for its own control over the country? And secondly, I thought, okay, even if you seriously engage in this, what portion of the Arab world or the Arab population are you impacting? Now, I was told that Qatar was more interested in globalization, i.e. Qatar vis-a-vis the whole world rather than Qatar vis-a-vis the Arab population. So you wonder what kind of an impact, what scope would the impact have on the Arab youth?
Well, that's very interesting. That's a perfect point to bring Vali Nazar in back in. I wonder what your response is, because I notice that people have said to you, sometimes in response to your book, Vali Nazar, well, there are two different middle classes, for instance, emerging in Turkey, which you hold up, as a very interesting place to look at. And they have different responses to this prosperity that they're gaining. How do you answer that?
Well, first of all, let me just say a bit about the previous point. The more important of these little states in the Persian Gulf is Dubai. And these, small states, Abu Dhabi, Dubai, Doha, as well as Professor Kassab says, don't reflect the dynamic of the larger societies. What they really reflect, and in particular Dubai, and not the ruling elite there, but the many Muslims who come from the rest of the Muslim world to do business in Dubai and to enjoy the fruits of what Dubai presents. That means Kazakhs, Iranians, Pakistanis, many Arabs who go there, essentially serve as proof of concept that given an opportunity in a proper regulatory environment, they're perfectly capable of behaving in an economic sense, just like middle classes and entrepreneurs and businessmen and those who are engaged in the market in any other part of the world. And the wealth that they gather, they pretty much are interested in the same things that people elsewhere in the world are interested in, which is quality of life, consumption, and the like. But in larger Muslim countries like Indonesia, Malaysia, and Turkey, and Indonesia in this case actually does have a very poignant colonial history, not very different from Egypt or many Latin American countries, you do see that engagement with global markets does force a change in state, because it requires countries to open up their trade. It requires governments to remove red tape. It requires bureaucracies to reform. It requires new laws. And some of these laws just apply to commerce, some of them apply to human rights and politics as well. It's a slow process of change, but there is no doubt that the Turkish state has been completely transformed, not because of just democracy, but the democracy part really relies on the globalization of the Turkish economy, and you're having the same process happen in Indonesia and the like. And this very much parallel to the process that we've seen in Latin America and East Asia. And I think in many ways the questions Dr. Kassab raised is how intellectuals may debate and respond to these economic political processes. Now, in the case of many Muslim countries, and Turkey, as you mentioned, there is a difference with the rest of the world in the sense that you did have a middle class that is pre-existing. In some countries, it was larger and more influential than in others that was tied to the state. In Turkey, it was tied to Kemalism. It was secular. It was a creation of the Kemalist state. And economically, it depended on salaries of the government or large enterprises supported by the government.
Yeah.
And then you have a new middle class that is emerging that does not see itself as a product of Kemalism. In fact, it's much more Islamic in its viewpoint. It's not tied to the large urban centers, but smaller towns in Anatolia. And it's not tied to the state for its economic well-being, but it's actually connected very much to Europe and the United States and through the export industry. And it is becoming much more influential and powerful and economically much more vibrant. And in some ways, you do have a clash between these two middle classes happening. And this obviously is something unique to Turkey. It may be unique to other Muslim countries as well. But still, within the debate between them, you're seeing many new ideas about how the Turkish state ought to be organized, what should be its relationship to Islam and culture and secularism, and how should it handle judicial reform, economic reform, and the like. And that, I think, is a hopeful sign. We don't know which way it goes, but you're seeing significant shifts happening in the way a state was organized in a fairly authoritarian way for several decades and now is entering a completely new phase.
Yes, I certainly think Turkey is a work in progress and one of the most fascinating ones. Look, finally to you, Dr. Kassab, you suggested that some of the devastating points of view you collected from Arab intellectuals, unhappiness is the best distributed thing in the Arab world, was one.
Yes.
Censorship is the biggest cultural institution that grew in the Arab world after 1967, which you regard as a turning point in Arab morale, with Israel so quickly defeating Egypt.
Yeah.
Yet you also suggest, this is the hopeful part, that 2005 was another turning point year for the better. Why so?
Well, because you had an independence movement in Lebanon, you had a social movement, Kifaya, in Egypt. There was just before that a sense of hope in Syria called the Damascus Spring. There was a sense of little hope, a timid hope that maybe things were going to change, in the sense that people were going to change the state of affairs in their countries. And unfortunately, as we know, all of these were more or less defeated. And I go back to the devastating effects of the post-colonial states on all of these countries, and the middle class, which was associated with liberal values, was dismantled by nationalization policies, and then the new states, with the so-called revolutionary states, which came into power in the 60s and 70s, really disrupted the social tissue by creating repression and censorship forms and all of that. And I think that we are in a landscape of social political disenfranchisement on the one hand, and then social disintegration, the collapse of education. And so the devastation is so big that for you to create a positive, constructive opposition is really, really a big challenge.
Mm. Well, look, thank you both. As I said, this will just be a snapshot, I'm afraid, of a very much bigger discussion, and maybe we might have you back. Professor Vali Naza, thank you very much to you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Elizabeth Kassab, thank you to you.
Thank you.
And Dr. Kassab is Research Fellow at the German Orient Institute in Beirut, and her book is Contemporary Arab Thought, Cultural Critique in Contemporary Perspective. It's a Columbia University Press publication. And Vali Naza is Professor of International Politics at Tufts University, and his book, his latest one, is Forces of Fortune, The Rise of the New Muslim Middle Class and What It Will Mean for Our World. It's a Simon and Schuster publication, and I really do believe that both those people will have quite a considerable impact on the way the debate unfolds, which I'd welcome you to join. Coming up next, we're going to talk about the debate of our times, it would seem, schools and education.